Oh, hey, Kate.
Oh, hi, Ryan. Do I need Invisaligns? Do I need to straighten up my teeth?
Is something that I cannot answer for you, particularly because we just turned the video aspect of this whole endeavor off.
Then what am I even doing here? I was promised hand-holding
Dental advice.
therapy, dental advice.
That's what Unrolled's really about. That's this big transition is just we're moving to a show that is entirely based around dental advice.
It was only a matter of time.
Yes.
There's much to talk about today, but the thing I want to start with is a huge congratulations for completing your clinic hours in
Thank
record
you.
frickin' time.
Feel like all of the exhaustion of the last 10 months is hitting me in this moment, right this instant. So, I apologize for the next hour as it unfolds. I might just fall off of my little stool here and take a nap while Kate sings you a song.
Hey
But
guys, you're listening. Should I get Invisaligns? I'm just going to write a musical inquiry.
But yes, I finished all 200 clinical hours that I need to apply for my massage therapy license.
So that's it?
And
That's all you got to do? You're done?
no, so the next steps are a little strange because they don't actually often have folks who finish clinicals before the classes are done. So I have to wait and like compile as much of the paperwork as I can, and then the last official day of class is September 15th. So on like September 16th, I'm gonna need to like do a bunch of running around and finding a notary and running downtown and getting everything signed and sealed and delivered, and then I'll get my license.
So, how come most people don't do it that way?
Don't finish there. Oh, just I very much. I probably realized in May how draining this whole process was. Actually, the process isn't draining. It's doing the process and not getting compensated for it, and not and running and my own business and teaching, like all of that together was very overwhelming. So I decided to like drop a couple of classes and basically sign up for every possible hour that I could physically make it into the school. And managed to get it done a lot quicker than most. There are a bunch of people in my class who will be finished before that last day of class or shortly thereafter. But it definitely is a slog. Like if someone were going into clinic one day a week, it would be almost impossible to finish within even 18 months. But I will say though, it is interesting because the state only actually requires 100, but the school requires 200. And I will say that like somewhere around like 125, I was like, oh, I kind of know a little bit of what I'm doing. Like it was just like very clear that some other mode clicked in.
That's awesome.
So, as much as it was a slog, I was really grateful, or am really grateful for everybody that came in that I knew and everyone that came in that I didn't know to just have a chance to work on. Probably wasn't 200 different bodies because definitely people came back a bunch of times. but to have 200 sessions with folks, I do think is really helpful. Even though I probably won't be doing much in the way of slathering people with oil, now that I'm out of school.
I missed the window of oil slather.
Yes. So now I just have, 5 more classes left, and then I'm good to go. And yeah, I'm like still in disbelief that it's actually coming to an end and it's going to be done like months earlier than I anticipated. Yeah, and I don't know, whenever you finish something like this, it's always like, what the fuck just happened to me? It's been quite a year. So, here I am. I'm excited to, you know, be a human being again and, like, see my friends and live my life and not pay tuition. Those are all things that I'm very excited about.
I think your life is about to take some really interesting twists and turns and accelerations now.
I think so too. I think so too. We shall see. We shall see. And how are you doing, Kate?
Do you really want me to answer that question, Brian?
Yes, I do. I do. Because I know it's a can of worms that will mean that I get to listen intently and not have to think of things to say.
It all started long ago. 3 generations back in County Cork. A widower, struggling to plow the potato fields, knew there must be a brighter dawn on the horizon for his bespeckled, freckled offspring. And so, thrusting my people up and out of the potato blight, okay, I'm going to stop. I just laughed and felt it in a fallopian tube, and I need to know that.
Fair. I like that you were about to ask me that, because no, I have not felt...
So, Ryan, have you felt it? No. So, you know, life has been wild lately, and I've just been, like, so blessed with friendships and support during a really rough time, and also just like wildly unexpected and hysterical challenges that have been popping up. And the most recent was, I was babysitting my dear friend's 2-year-old, and we went on some adventures in my new car, which is in fact a manual. Did we talk about a manual?
Not on the podcast, but we certainly talked about it.
Gotta tell you, you should recount. Okay, so let's back up for a minute. I needed a car. Emergency situation, like my life's on fire, and I desperately quickly needed a car that was affordable. And a really dear friend of mine, who actually started a podcast you should check out called Resilient Vagina, sent me her car. I don't know why I'm not saying her name. I'm like afraid of her privacy. I want to be respectful of that. Anyways, it's Nikki. Nikki fucking generously sent me a car, and I paid for shipping, and she was getting a new car, and I was so grateful. And she is just like one of the smartest people I know, and also loves driving manuals, like loves it. She feels way more in control with the car. She thinks it's more of a joy to drive. And I know people like this. This is a thing. This is a type of person that likes this. And so I said to her, I don't know if I can do it, man. I don't know if I can learn. And she's like, you can do it. And I was like, okay, I can do it. Are you still there? Have I lost you?
Yeah, I'm right here with you.
Okay. So here comes the car. And here comes my dad to teach me how to drive it. And so we drove to the Seekonk Speedway, which is like an actual thing, apparently, where they race cars in Seekonk, Massachusetts. And there's a big empty lot, which my father and I, he watched me, you know, frickin' stall that car out a good 1,500 times. We went for a light lunch at Cello's and then got in back in the car and kept going. And eventually I learned, and all of a sudden it hit me like a ton of bricks. Oh my fucking God, this is like the yoga of driving, because it becomes an exercise of integration of the left side of your brain and the right, and listening to the breathing of the engine, because that's real communicator. That's when you know it's time to switch gears or back off on the clutch. Like, it became poetry in motion. It was a goddamn prayer. And I wasn't that great at it, just like I'm not that great at regular yoga. And so I'm finally getting confident. I drive that car and we realize, okay, my rental car is at my brother's house. And I have to get this car to my mom's house. So my dad and I drive to my mom's house. Now, my mom and dad haven't been in the same car in about 30 years because they're divorced. And and I pull up and I say, Mom, you got to get in the car with Dad. And she's like, why? And I'm like, because we got to drive this pony back to Mike's and I got to return my rental car because I can drive this car now. And she's like, oh, that's wonderful. We get in the car and I, of course, stall it out about 7 times. And she looks at me and goes, Katie, I don't know if you should be driving this on the road. And my dad said, you're doing great. You're going to have this thing spinning on its nose in a couple hours. And there I sat in an absolute meditation of what it was like to grow up with those two. Like, unflappable arrogance coupled with like unflappable and unmovable anxiety, both sitting in the car with me saying, go, 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 stop, we're in danger. And so I got all three of us over to my brother's, and here we go. Good thing the next day I had to go pick up my daughter in a car I don't know really how to drive all that well, through two cities. And I did it, and I was so proud of myself. And it really is kind of fun to drive. It does take muscle memory, and like, you know, I probably beat the shit out of that car in 3 days. All of this is to say, as I started getting confident, it was time now for me to take someone else's child in that car on an adventure. Because while I've been going through one of the most difficult seasons of my life, I have also been free to do things I actually want to do, which mostly involve going outside and like going to the ocean or going to the woods and like just fucking like living my life in a way I haven't been kind of like allowed to in a while. And so I got my friend's amazing son into my car and we drove to the zoo, and that went well. And then I said, why don't we go to the beach? And we got to the beach just fine. And then we came home, and 5 minutes before being in the front door, I had to get off on an on-ramp, you know, get off the highway. And the car decided now would be a good time to shit the bed. And so the car broke down, blocking traffic on an off-ramp.
Okay.
With a 2-year-old in the back seat during like 115 degrees.
Oh my God.
And I just was like, you know what? It's okay. I've got AAA. And if you don't have AAA, you go do that right now. Right now. Stop the podcast. Stop it. Press pause. We'll be here when you get back. Go do it. Anyways.
Or we could just leave an awkward pause.
Let's just leave the pause and let it happen. So I called AAA and they're like, okay, so just tell us where you are. And I tried to describe it. And like, long story short, this poor fucking tow truck driver is like circling and circling. And I'm like, look, dude, I need you to imagine, where's the worst place for a car to break down? Where's the worst place? That's where I am. And he was like, oh my God, I see you. And so he came and got me. And long story short, I blew the clutch, Ryan, which means I blew the fucking clutch. And so now it's sitting at an auto shop where they told me that to repair it is going to cost just about as much as, almost like half as much as it's worth. And so I'm sitting with the spiritual decision of this noble car that was so well loved and so well cared for by the previous owner. I don't want to let go of, you know, but I also need to be able to have a car that I can drive without totally destroying it, because that's not good karma for me, is to just beat up on a car. You know, that car deserves the respect of someone that can drive it. So in the next couple of hours, I will discover what the fate is of Phineas, the name of the car.
Oh, my God.
And eventually I'll have wheels. But no matter what, and I attribute this to having a yoga practice, my perspective on it has been more of like hysterical, distant curiosity about the shit show that my life has become. And like, I feel like I've been able to find such abundant moments of unexpected and hysterical joy. Uh-huh. That, you know, either that or it's my brain's last attempt to keep me from throwing myself off of a fucking bridge. Like, I mean that like mostly in jest.
Yeah.
But it's amazing. Like, I am sometimes baffled at the results of having a yoga practice and how grateful I am that I had it in place.
Yeah.
Which brings me to a topic I wanted to talk about with you, which is yoga nidra. And the reason reason I want to bring it up is because that meditation and yoga nidra and like basically gentle hatha have been like my yoga du jour. It's like all I can handle. It's all I want. It's all I crave. It's kind of how I'm teaching right now. Even in my heated classes, which is always very confusing for folks.
Hi, staff at Down Under Yoga. You weren't meant to hear that.
No, my Saturday morning heated class is we do like some restorative sort of quote unquote, I hate this word, but a little bit of therapeutic stuff in the morning, you know, and then we do our flow and shit. But I think the reason that that group sort of gravitated to their classes because like you can get a good old fashioned ass kicking every other morning, but Saturday, maybe we mellow out a tick.
Yeah.
But long story short, in my personal practice, I've been employing the resources of the, what is it called? The meditation app I'm using. Do you not know?
Space?
Maybe.
Calm?
I don't know. Let me look at it.
10% happier?
Oh my God, there's so many. So I've been using one, and I actually want to give a shout out to this person because I've been falling asleep to their voice. It's called the Insight Timer.
Oh yeah. That's the one I use, but I don't use the recorded function. I just use the timer.
Yeah. So normally I use the timer for like daytime meditation. I just said that, but then at night I've been obsessed with Jennifer Piercy, her yoga nidra. This is a bitch I'd be friends with.
Yeah.
There is a sense of humor to her yoga nidra that is like she's just a little bit dry and her descriptions are just a little bit unexpected and there is nothing obvious about it.
Yeah.
And so she works really well for me because I don't do well with like saccharine bullshit yoga nidra. I cannot do it. I get furious. And that's like not the point.
In case anybody was wondering.
That's not what I'm here for with my yoga nidra. It's just like rage induction. But Jennifer Piercy, yoga nidra, she has like a handful of them on and they're free and they're wonderful. So I fall asleep to those. But it got me thinking about like how important it is to have a diversified approach to your yoga. Like you, I as every year in my life goes by and hands me more and more thrilling gifts in the form of disasters, I become more clear on, oh God, fall in love with as many different modalities of like of yoga as you can, you know, find as many that serve you, because the thing that serves you right now, if you are myopic about it, can be taken away and will be taken away. I don't care what it is. It can and will be taken away. That's life. This is, you know, Buddhism 101. So,
well, it'll change. It'll shift. It'll, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think, so I think there's a difference between, like, I see so many people who are really good at, like, how do I phrase this? At collecting these little bits and pieces from this place, from that place, from this place, from that place. But what's really rare, and I don't know that I don't actually think of it as a problem. I just think of it as a time issue. Meaning that maybe there aren't enough folks who have really been practicing long enough that we've really seen this, but I've been lucky enough to have older teachers who have begun to do the work of integrating all of those skills and really being clear that the skill that they of something like a yoga nidra or something like meditation or something like a particular posture or a particular movement modality, the skill development is different than the integration and application of those skills.
Okay, can you say that again in a different way?
Yes. So for instance, you could learn restorative yoga and then yin yoga and then I'm just trying to think of things that people would be familiar with that are marketed as like distinct things.
Yeah, Reiki, throw that in.
Reiki,
there.
Craniosacral therapy, I don't know, Ashtanga yoga, like the list could go on and on and on. Bartiniev fundamentals, Feldenkrais, etc., 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 etc. And like you have all of these skills floating around, and there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's great. And like building enough skill, enough not skill, building. I don't want to use the word acquiring, but gathering enough skills in order to take care of yourself and live well is a really worthwhile thing that takes a really long time. But then at some point, you have to kind of like hold all of that within a slightly bigger umbrella, which capitalism doesn't necessarily want us to do, especially if we're yoga teachers. So like a very small example would be like for years I taught active classes and restorative classes and active classes and restorative classes and active classes and restorative classes. But probably around the time that we met, there was a distinct like, oh, these things aren't separate. They're not two really distinct expressions of yoga. They're just a set of skills, and so I can integrate them as freely as I want in my own practice, and I can integrate them as freely as I want in my teaching practice, as long as it's clear what the purpose of the posture or the purpose of the class is. So it might be skillful to, within the context of a class that's oriented around relaxation, to do something quite engaged, because sometimes the only way to have a context for what is relaxed is to have a context for what is excessively tense. And so it becomes it becomes a much more integrated approach to practice, you know, and you can do that and still honor the influences that taught you these things. Someone who I think does that really, really well is Sarah Powers. And, you know, I haven't studied with her extensively, but I've taken with her in like interesting increments when she's come to town, and noticed that less and less is it a like yin workshop and then a yang workshop. It's like all of these things start to blend together, all of the influences start to integrate. And the thing is that that just takes time and a lot of practice. But I think it's worth having an eye on integration, because so often this like gathering of modalities is tied up in the ability to teach and have multiple revenue streams. So maybe before integration, there's really like you're gathering skills, you're learning distinct skills and distinct techniques, and then there's the mild trial and error of applying those to your circumstances and potentially to other people's circumstances if you're teaching folks. And then there might be a sense of like, okay, this is the thing that's like underpinning the whole situation, that holds all of that knowledge in a really interesting and useful way. So that's the thing that I get a little like, if I think of something like Yoga Nidra, like what is the skill that's actually being learned?
This is what I was interested in talking to you about. What the fuck is it?
Okay, so
Let's back up. Yoga Nidra. Now, I think I get suspicious when I think of a tool like Yoga Nidra and then linking it back textually, thousands of years, and saying that this yoga nidra that we practice in 2019, or this thing we call yoga nidra that we practice in 2019, is as old as yoga itself. And I certainly am not going to claim to be a historian of any stretch of the imagination in this department, but I think that it's possible that it's just not that old. And well, certainly what we're doing right now is not that old. I mean, we can start with the most obvious, which is I'm listening to a recording on a phone. Let's start with the means of delivery, the transmission of teachings. I have, with a basic Google search, it's posited that it is linked back to the Mahabharata, Book 1, Section 21, from this particular passage. The ocean becomes the bed of the lotus-navelled Vishnu when, at the termination of every yuga, that deity of immeasurable power enjoys yoga nidra, the deep sleep under the spell of spiritual meditation. That's like, okay, well, yeah, that feels like a mention.
At the end of the day, though, what's interesting to me is that every system that I can think of, and maybe someone is going to tell me that I'm wrong, but that would probably be because I don't know every methodology or every system like the back of my hand. But whether we're talking yoga, whether we're talking Buddhism, whatever it is, there is some fundamental notion that a relative quieting of the mind, the body, the emotional states is somewhat necessary for practice. Yogaschittavritti Nirodha. Yoga is the stilling of the patterns of consciousness, or whatever translation of that second Patanjali sutra you want to utilize. So, the first thing that I learned in the context of Buddhism was shamatha, which is a technique of meditation that is really focused around what's referred to as calm abiding meditation sometimes. And I think when I look at it through that lens, I just think of yoga nidra as, people are utilizing the different possibilities of where we can place our awareness and what we can do with our imagination and how we can visualize things and how we can move our attention from this to this to this to this to try and prompt some sense of relative quieting. And the tricky thing to me is that I never quite understood is that if someone needs a recording to do it, like that seems a little like if the recording is helpful, let the recording be helpful. For sure, it's a wonderful tool, but it doesn't seem to get people off of the recording.
Oh, interesting. So, and if this is not what you're saying, correct me. So, if somebody theoretically was practicing like a yoga video at home, eventually they could take those tools and practice on their own without the video. Is there a analogous corresponding scenario with a yoga nidra recording? And yeah, you're totally right. No.
I mean, but
So
there it's not that there
can
couldn't.
one, can you practice, how does one practice yoga nidra without the linguistic buttressing of an outside source?
Yeah. And the truth is someone, depending on what you're defining as yoga nidra, there might need to be some sort of focal point in the movement towards relaxation, but you could absolutely establish a simple enough context that someone could move their awareness from their foot to their shin to their thigh to their hip to their sacrum to their lower back to their back of the rib cage. So like you could create enough of a map in terms of a body scan that someone could very easily re remember that. You could also make it really. You could, to a certain extent, like it can be nice to be guided by those things, but also there's always a point for me when I'm being guided through those things. And I never necessarily use a recording, but like in class, where I have to actively tune the person leading out so that I can. It's not that I'm not hearing them, but I'm really not paying attention to them anymore because either there is something that I'm paying attention to that is settling, or that I am so settled that the sound of their voice is pulling me out of that state of relaxation.
And if we step back for a second and look at the marketing around yoga nidra, there is never an implication that this is a thing you can do on your own. The implication with yoga nidra practice and how we sell it is that it's a special performance event where somebody is going to guide you through the river of experience that is almost an artistic performance linguistically.
Which there's nothing wrong with that. It's kind of like
No,
going
I love it.
to a poetry reading.
Yes, it is going to a restorative yoga poetry reading.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's why I dig it.
That makes sense to me.
Wow. Sorry, that sort of just like opened up a couple doors in my head.
Interesting.
I feel like it is a magnificent hand holding.
Yeah.
Good yoga nidra is like, it's gonna be okay for you to be quiet in your mind and body, and here's how.
Yeah.
And so for that reason, I think it is, it can be, if done well and for your, predilections, that is. But if now I have stumbled upon some recordings that are just so terrible, and that's always fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yoga nidra has been big on my mind in my personal practice right now, and
No one's ever explained to me, and this is probably a side topic that I will ask some people about, is what is the difference between that and a sustained practice of Shavasana?
Shavasana is free range.
Does it have to be though? Or does yoga nidra is describing a state that is potentially a little bit deeper than your standard Shavasana?
I don't know that I'd say deeper, but I would say I think that because it's in a container, it can be potentially more down-regulating for some.
Okay. I guess the thing, I mean, the real thing is that you are not, if you are following and scanning some sort of map of yourself or some sort of visualization or, whatever the case may be, to a certain extent, the mind has to exert the effort to generate and follow that map. Whereas if someone else is speaking and guiding, then the mind obviously still has to choose to pay attention to it, but it's not doing as much of the generation
Yes,
of the content.
which is one less thing fatigued.
Yes.
Also, the relationship of yoga nidra and actual sleep is interesting.
Say more.
So I toggle back and forth between yoga nidras and like things that are recordings that are designed specifically to help you sleep. And I often find it difficult to tell the difference.
Yeah. That's
You
fair.
know, rest though is interesting. Cultivating as many accessible different modes of rest is what I think I'm interested in, so that not all rest is in the form of, just straight up a nap.
Yeah. I actually cannot. I was talking with my friend Fez about this. I don't like napping. No one should ever have to deal with my grumpiness of waking up twice in the course of a day. That's not fair to me or anybody else. But I can absolutely conk out in a restorative pose in the studio and then wake up 12 to 20 minutes later and be refreshed. But if I curl up on the couch and in my bed, it's full sleep mode, and then I have to go through the morning grumpiness all over again.
No way. That's interesting.
Oftentimes I'll do, I don't know if I got this from Fez or if I picked this up somewhere else, but I'll either starting from Shavasana or starting from the Supta Baddha on an incline, I'll do a good long while in lying on my back, and then a little bit lying on each side, left and right, or right and left, and then lying supported prone, and then a brief child's pose. And that's kind of my go-to either like recharge, like I'm feeling frantic, and really not able to focus on one thing. That is a thing that I will routinely go to. I'll also do that sometimes before meditation if I like sit down on my cushion and I feel like I'm things are just too squirrely to really sit. I'll do that first and then
too squirrely. Yeah.
And then, you know, I can always find different ways to sort of support and start that sequence, but it's basically just lie on your back, lie on your side, lie on your front, like grounding each part of the body into something.
Yeah, so that's interesting. Because basically what's happening is you're able to get all the benefits of napping without dropping into the, you know, the REM or whatever part of the cycle that actually, like, you know, induces some hormonal changes that, that make you wake up grumpy.
Yeah.
Huh. So there is a study that talks about Yoga Nidra from 2002 that basically posited that Yoga Nidra increased dopamine tone during meditation-induced change of consciousness. And that was published in the Cognitive Brain Research in 2002. So this is interesting because dopamine release can cause the reduced desire for action. Huh. As a recovering addict, I'm always looking for ways to, you know, take some good pills without actually taking them, you know? And maybe that's what it is.
That's fair. That's fair.
Yeah, so I'm suspicious about the actual history of Yoga Nidra. Got to look into that a little bit more. But wait, like, I'm just wondering if it's, yeah, if I were going to guess, it's actually the intersection of meditation, probably some schools of Buddhism, and restorative yoga that probably started to gain in popularity somewhere in the 70s or 80s. That would be my, like, I don't actually know, but if I were a betting woman and I were in Vegas, that's what I'd put my money on.
But I think it's important to, like, obviously the term Yoga Nidra shows up in, like, there, as you mentioned, there are text references, but like the text references describing a state that may have been like it is different than the like Yoga Nidra TM.
Yes,
that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, and you know, the Old Testament also has lots of mentions of a virgin birth, but it could be that we were misreading the word virgin for young woman. Like,
yes.
I'm real suspicious of.
Yeah.
So, topic. Nuance.
Just tossing the ball right over.
that's my work.
No, I think the discussion that we've had so far. You know, I've just been thinking a lot about why when I see or hear or whatever the case may be, or read so many of the discussions around the state of modern yoga practice, that I just get so pissed off. And it really doesn't, it's not, it's funny because it's not that someone defending, how should I say this? It actually has nothing to do with the stance that someone is taking. Like, they could be taking a stand on either side of something that I could agree or disagree about. And I still, like, there's an underlying, like, just mild rage beneath the surface of whether I disagree or agree with whatever they're saying. And I think, I don't know that nuance is the right word. I think, though it might be, I think that what I am responding to is that there, we talk time and time again about yoga needing to be sort of individuated, at least the like practical on the mat yoga, or on the cushion yoga, individuated to the person who's doing the doing, right? But then we teach group classes where we have to generalize, and in that generalization we lose some of that communication. And then when we start to have these like meta discourses over what's going on in yoga culture, it seems to be that sort of the same loss, but like exponentially more. And I'm trying to think of a good example. But it's a lot of like maybe folks not being able to hold two seemingly divergent points of view at the same time, which is to me what one skill that yoga has really helped me with is the ability to be like, oh, okay, I can see where that stream of thought is coming from, and I can see where this stream of thought is coming from, and at least in a reflective context hold both of those in my mind. And then, yeah, there might be something that points me in one direction or another in terms of action or in terms of opinion or in terms of what I value, but still actually being able to hold those two points of view at the same time, in a reflective manner. And I just find that whether we're talking about how the knee moves, or whether we're talking about, you know, should or shouldn't there be adjustments in yoga class, or whether we're talking about, you know, whether one person finds a particular teacher's style of instructional delivery to be too harsh, you know, there's this like drive to sort of push everything toward this like idealized perfect form of yoga where there will be no mistakes made and there will be no harm done. And it's like this just can't happen on a relative level. Does that make sense?
Like, the water is so inherently murky and...
Everything is so
old with history murky. That let's just have a more... Let's use a scalpel and not a machete.
Yeah. Let's, you know, examine where things are actually coming from and where things are actually arising from and what things arose just for sort of stylistic and purposes and what things arose for capitalistic purposes and what things, you know, just to really, you know, and not necessarily needing to find like distinct answers, but just to be reflective about the whole thing. to take the time to be like, oh, okay, I just taught a class. How'd that go? You know, what were things that were probably helpful and what were things that maybe weren't so helpful to the folks in the room? And to just have everybody out there doing that reflection on their own feels like more where we need to be than making these big, like, pronouncements about, you know, the right way to be trauma sensitive, which is like okay. The silliest
yes.
thing in yes. my, like, that stuff drives me up the fucking wall, because like trauma sensitive to whose trauma?
Thank you for saying that. So I had as someone that loves a fiery and universal and sweeping pronouncement of rage, I get it. I like the hyperbole. I like the, hey, if this is what it takes to get some attention, to talk about a topic yeah. that maybe needs some light shine on it, I love it. Give me some clickbait linguistically. I love it. It's okay. Say it. You know? And I think you can make a pronouncement like that and then go forth and unpack it with nuance. And
absolutely.
Like,
but that's
responsibility and history. So that's what I like. That's the direction I like to go in. It's like, let's say something inflammatory and then let's like backpedal. But what you were just mentioning specifically about the trauma thing is, you know, I got into a discussion a few weeks back with some yoga teachers that were just talking about how, you know, they're so sick of all the different types of yoga, trauma-informed yoga trainings out there. They're like, oh, there's so many, and it shouldn't be yoga teachers that are leading these. It should be people that are, you know, thought leaders in the clinical therapy communities. It should be people with their master's and their doctorate specifically in therapy that are leading the charge. And I realized that I agreed with one of those statements and not the other. And one is, yeah, I sort of am like suspicious and always have been of trauma-informed trainings because, again, who's trauma? And
yeah.
There is the implied universal approach to things you can and cannot do to somebody that is living with PTSD or complex PTSD is super problematic, and people that are even doctors specializing in that field agree with that. I do not think that how to treat or how to use yoga to support people living with trauma can only be taught by freaking therapists or yoga teachers that are therapists, because that is so problematic, because, well, what the fuck? I think that it's, I am of the belief that there is always more than one way to skin a cat.
Yeah.
And that the conversation and the diversity of approaches is important. And also the really rigorous criticisms, productive criticisms of each methodology is super important. I teach from a trauma-informed perspective of, hey guys, here's the reading I've done. Here's what's worked for me, and here's what's been useful to students that I've worked with. And here you go. And remember, there's no one way to do this. You cannot say, no, you can't do Happy Baby if you're a woman with PTSD, because of course you were raped on your back.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it is, nothing is linear about trauma.
Yeah.
Or healing from trauma. And so stepping away from certainty and just providing tools that are sort of the birthright of anybody that's practicing yoga is what we're doing. Like, and what are some smart things we can do with our space?
Yeah.
And what are some fucking tools that you should give all humans? Quite frankly, this isn't something that is, that's the other thing that pisses me off. Like, all of those tools that you would want to bring to your classroom for a trauma-informed room, you should damn well be bringing into your just general population room.
Yeah. Well, then there's also, like, you know, I also don't want to, it's, like, similar to what was happening with the safety conversation, like, 10 years ago, of just, like, okay, well, I guess we can't do anything in yoga class anymore because everyone's getting injured. and, you know, we have seen the results of that, like, And some of this is good, some of this, you know, I question, but I notice far fewer inversions being taught, which on one hand is great because I think the efficacy, the insistence that I learn how to stand on my head was a little strange looking back on it. But at the same time, now realize that, like, you know, we did scare ourselves a little bit out of doing things that at least within the context of hatha yoga practice can be helpful to some folks in some situations. And now sometimes I get this feeling with the trauma sensitivity conversation, that, like, you know, when you make those broad statements like don't do happy baby or don't do Supta Baddha Konasana because it's too much of a vulnerable position, it's just like, well, vulnerable for whom and in which context and where are they located in the room and just what kind of fucking day are they having? Like, and regardless of what day they have, like, you don't know what's gonna trigger something, even in someone who does not have like a pronounced case of PTSD or anything like that. Like, I don't know what's going to make me profoundly uncomfortable and feel like I don't want to do something from an emotional standpoint or from a physical standpoint in the context of yoga class. Like, I could be having a great day and then be in a class and be like, oh, I'm not doing that today. Like, that is there. I'm just not doing that today. And then I have to look at, like, okay, well, what about that is like, what about that is causing that feeling? And I'm lucky enough to like not have any like extensive trauma to the point where like that feeling of I can't do that right now is paralyzing. And have enough space to be like, okay, what's happening here? Like, why do I not want to go into shoulder stand? Like, why does this feel so claustrophobic all of a sudden? What the hell's going on? You know, and
And empowering them to empowering people to make those decisions with that discernment and practice self-care and wise choices because triggers are inevitable.
So many complex things just came up again about Anna Forrest when you said
Yes, say more.
that. People used to always quote her as saying, like, never waste a good trigger, except that she herself is perhaps one of the most triggering humans to me that I ever encountered in the yoga world. And I don't think she would give two shits about me saying that either. So.
Never waste it. Ooh. You're quiet.
You know, I have never recounted that particular story on the podcast, and I don't want to because it just it doesn't feel helpful to me. It just feels, it doesn't feel helpful to me.
Oh, no. I'm certainly not going to encourage you to do that, but my question is, what do you think is meant by the term never waste a good trigger?
So I think of it this way, like I think of it in the context of meditation. It is inevitable that when I sit, especially if I'm sitting for like 45 minutes or something like that, which is kind of what I try to shoot for each day, that like shit's gonna come up, like something's gonna come up. And sometimes difficult shit comes up. And in that moment, I try to be really clear with myself that I could lean into that a little bit and inquire, but I also could, as one of my friends, Rod, sometimes says, change the channel. Like, I could just be like, I'm going to put that aside. I'm just going to let that be over here. I know that it's there. I'm aware that it came up. I'm not rejecting it. I'm not pushing it away. I'm just going to pay attention to something that calms or quiets or soothes until that kind of passes away, and then move on with the meditation. But I could also lean in and be like, wow, why is this coming up? Like, what is this? What does this feel like? Where does this feel like? What's going on? Can I be with this as it comes up? But we have to be really careful in the discourse around meditation that, you know, the instruction isn't always to lean in. Sometimes the instruction is to, like, get off the cushion and go do something else. And I think that that's really important. And then that also has to be balanced with, like, no, sometimes you stay on the cushion. Like, the value of having a container in, like, a retreat format is, like, you have the ability to just kind of go with the program that's set and watch what the structure of that program within reason brings up. And then within reason, you know, you might have to go take a break. Like, I'm always someone when I go on retreat where I will stick to that fucking schedule. Like, they put a schedule out, I'm going to stick with it. And I remember very clearly being up at Karma Choling in Vermont, and it was probably the first week-long retreat that I sat. And this wonderful teacher, John Rockwell, was leading the retreat. And he was actually, it was really great because it was the first time that I had been up there that someone had taken advantage of, like, the gorgeous land and not just, like, locked us in the shrine room, and not locked, of course, but, like, just had us in the shrine room all day meditating. Like, we would meditate. We'd do a good long sit in the morning, and then we'd, like, go, like, he'd give, like, an assignment to, like, go out and work with almost like a walking meditation technique up through the trails and up into the mountains. But anyways, I remember having this really, really difficult day, like probably one of the most difficult days of retreat that I could can remember, just in terms of stuff coming up and really struggling. And I was like, gonna stay on that fucking cushion. Like, that was not gonna move. Like, I was gonna get through this, because I'd always just been taught, like, something's coming up, just keep sitting. Something's coming up, just keep sitting. It'll pass away. Everything's impermanent. Just keep sitting. And so that's what I did. I just kept sitting. And I remember very clearly at one point, someone else was, like, keeping time up at the front of the room. And he would always put his cushion at the back of the room when that was happening, to just sort of, like, observe the room as people were meditating. And he came up next to me. Who knows whether he remembers this. And he, like, taps me on the shoulder and, like, motions me out of the shrine room and is like, you should go take a walk now. He's like, don't push what? Through this. Go take a walk. That's what the land is here for. Go take a walk. It's just like...
How did they know?
I have no idea to this day. I never asked him. But I went and I walked, like, way up high into the meadow and just, like... Whatever was, like, stirring in there just needed that space up there to let go of. Then, like, came back down an hour later and sat on the cushion, was, like, totally had everything and, like, kind of cleared. But it was just, that was, like, the first of many instances when I was, like, wow, this strategy of, like, just... It was the equivalent strategy of in asana, just like pushing through as hard as you can in every possible pose. That's what I was doing in meditation practice. And it was the first of like many, many experiences like, oh, I don't really need to do that. I could just acknowledge that sometimes it's okay to, like, sometimes it's not the right time to meditate, or sometimes the form of meditation looks different. So yeah. But that is to say, like, I think that the difficult thing that I see, especially around the it's both within the trauma informed, but also in the just in the way that asana is being instructed more broadly nowadays, is like there's this real lean towards do whatever feels right. And like, you gotta give people more of a context of choice. Like, you gotta guide people on a little bit more of an inquiry than do whatever feels like, because what if they don't know what the hell we're doing? That doesn't feel like a very safe place to practice yoga in to me, if I like didn't know what all of these down dog, up dog, triangle, side angle is, and then people are like, just do whatever you want. It the skill in balancing that is really being like, okay, here we are in this form. What does it feel like when you take your hand here? What does it feel like when you take your hand there? Can you feel that when you take your hand here, that there may be these possibilities that you can feel? Do you feel when you take your hand here, how you can support your head? And that, like, to actually give people a set of choices to make so that it still is a learning environment, not just like a free-for-all.
I don't know of anyone that does a free-for-all.
So I would agree with you, but if I oftentimes whenever I'm taking someone else's class, I will try to turn the part of my brain off that has been doing this for so long and be like, would I be able to track with what's. And a lot of times my perception is that it's even though maybe no one's saying just do whatever you want, or someone's still like marking the poses, there's still a lot of some of it is in the language of do what feels right. And I'm not against do what feels right. But what if there's a lack of clarity about what the purpose of the pose is? If someone interprets the purpose of doing Supta Padangusthasana as to get the strongest sensation through their hamstring as humanly possible because they've been acculturated to stretch is good, more stretch is better, painful stretch is great, then that's what feels quote-unquote good. But if the context of the pose is clearly given as this is what the purpose of this pose is today, I'm wanting you to feel X. And then what do you have to do in order to feel, like, what are the choices within that that would help you to feel that? What if you bent your knee a little bit this way? What if you moved the leg a little closer to straight? What if you turned your thigh bone slightly out? What if you turn your thigh bone slightly in? You know, you don't have to give like everything, but like to be clear about what the purpose of the pose is something that within the context of an asana class, I feel is sometimes lacking and might cause some of the do what feels right to you instruction to go subtly off the rails.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. So, and I'm just going to speak anecdotally from my own experience. Yeah, yeah. I use a lot of that kind of talk. And I find that there are times where when I have like a larger class and, you know, a pocket of people that's useful language for, useful things for them, and then there's like the group of people that are on the new member special and are like, what the fuck, man? So yeah, and they start looking around the room. Yeah. And I usually have been trying to use that as an opportunity of like, so what do I mean by what feels nourishing?
Yeah.
What I mean is, if you were experiencing sensation on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, coming up to a 10 might feel nourishing, but maybe let's question it, you know? And then I go on a long-winded thing where I'm like just chatting at him to start to like take inventory of some things, and the rest of the room knows how to like tune it out.
Sure.
So that's what I'm doing, and I don't say that. I don't offer that as like, oh, here's the solution. But that's just where I'm at in navigating that issue that I think is an important one, which is give people some damn agency and permission to discover what is useful about a shape, and also provide enough of a container that you're not like, oh my God, I feel shame.
Yeah. But then also, you know, I have moments like I took Tim's class the other day, and Tim Kelleher's class, and just what pose was I in? It was like maybe Prasarada Padottanasana, but like a narrow one, and just came by and like flicked the inside of my left arch, and was like, oh wow, my attention was not there at all. And like just led me down like a whole interesting like little exploration, because I was just, that was a little bit of a blind spot. So like I also don't want, and you know, that's obviously Tim's doing that to someone, like we've known each other for a long time, we practiced together for a long time, so like you always have to feel that out a little bit. But you know, I also don't want, I both don't want the like barking instructions at people, and also don't want to lose the like aha moment of like, it wasn't that I was doing something wrong with my arch, it was just that my awareness was everywhere but there. Like it was just such a clear blind spot, and then it actually led to a really useful set of choices in the pose that I wouldn't have already made. And so, yeah, so that's always my caution, is that I want, there still needs to be room for actual instruction to be given. Otherwise, this leads us back to our last conversation, the only time people get real instruction is when they go to a teacher training, or if they have enough money to purchase a private. You know what I mean? Like, so, you know, I just, sometimes it feels like yoga is holding the same space as let me say this carefully. A drop-in yoga class is holding the same cultural space as a spin class. And I don't, and in that people are coming in and they're expecting to get this very like delivered product and leave. And nothing wrong with spin. I love spin. But that yoga is a lot broader than that. And so, you know, we're still just trying to navigate these waters of like, wow, we've had all of these people who have really diligently practiced and taught, whether it's new or not, you can have that argument till the, you know, as long as you want, but have really brought this useful thing for us to practice. And there's some really useful skills to learn. There's really useful knowledge there. And there's also really fucked up shit about the delivery mechanism. Namely, you know, just some of the people that delivered it. and, you know, we have to be really like, it seems hypocritical to me to you know, unless you're the actual, like, it seems a little hypocritical to me the way that some people are having these trauma conversations and injury conversations, and of course I like the abuse conversation I just want to like put to the side, because that's a very extreme, but I'm interested in like how do we have the conversation of how can we do better, And oftentimes in the how can we do better, there's this like really strong pendulum swing towards do whatever, like let people do whatever they want. That's the only way. Like, and really to me, there's this like really like great middle ground of like, okay, well, what kind of hands-on assist do we actually as a culture or at, not even as a culture, like do I or do you want to offer in yoga class and in what way, given whatever understanding of these topics of trauma and these topics of abuse and the topics of just how historically a lot of these practices were presented with these really strong assists and with these really like stern patriarchal delivery mechanisms. How do you hold all of that knowledge and then be like, okay, this is how I'm going to try and do better. And then be like, whoop, misstep. Okay, here's how I'm going to try and do better. You know what I mean? Like, and the subtle back and forth of that, of like, I'm going to resolve to do better and to share this and communicate this in a way that's skillful. And then being like, okay, you know, maybe that wasn't so great. Or maybe like that's too universal a statement to make about that pose. Or maybe that, or oops, I didn't really ask that person before I gave them an adjustment. You know, oops, I misgendered someone in class. Or, it, you know, whatever the case may be. Is just to be like taking those little steps to reflect and be like, okay, I did that thing. I taught that class. Given everything that's shifting, how can I still resolve to do better? And know that it's going to change. So, I mean, if I just think about what I was teaching 10 years ago, not even how I was teaching it, but just like what I was teaching it, what I was teaching and what I am teaching now, that there is a huge difference. And then if you think about how I was teaching, and you know, the evolution of how yoga is presented, in the culture, there is starting to be an even bigger difference there. And I think that that will only continue to change. And, I think it takes more personal reflection and group discussion rather than sweeping generalization and this is the right way. And I agree with you. Sometimes the sweeping, like, you know,
it moves the ball out of center. That's what I think its utility is. It forces absolutely. The conversation.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes, especially if you can, when the person can state that, that it was like, okay, I said that to get your attention. Now that I have your attention, like let's talk about the thing. Right? Like, that I really appreciate when someone, like, uses the big sweeping statement, and you're like, what the fuck? And it's like, oh, okay, they were just, you know, trying to get, as you said, the ball away from center, or to just pull our minds out of its habitual consideration of whatever topic is going on. But it's actually really, you know, there's not many. People out there with which I can really. Sometimes when I have these discussions, it very quickly veers into, when I attempt to have these discussions, sometimes it veers into people trying to like give advice about how I should do it. And I was like, no, that's not what I asked for. Like, if I asked for like, how do you do it? Then yeah, tell me how do you do it. But like, I think what's valuable is the discussion. And of course, not only discussion, but reading up on these topics and being informed about the history of how this practice was presented, and being informed about the history of abuse, both physical and emotional and sexual and psychological. You know, definitely doing all of the the sometimes very difficult work to understand what's been going on. But then, like, trying to really bring it back to the fact that, like, at 10 o'clock, I had five people in class, and I taught some yoga. How'd that go? Like, yes, the big conversation, but also, like, I taught those five people. How'd that go? Both in what I taught, how I taught it, how I presented myself in front of the classroom, what I was feeling when I was teaching, what I was responding to in the room. How clear was I? Where did it seem like people were having confusion? Did I manually assist people? Did I not manually assist people? I don't really think I did today. What made me not do that? Et cetera, et cetera. And then to have that inquiry and be like, okay. And then you just start it all over the next day. As it, like, you start again.
Because you never step in the same river twice. No, no, you never step in the same river twice. Hey, that's why we all need Invisaligns. Something to hold it together, because those teeth are on the river of time. Hashtag gum health.
Wow. You brought that back around, dear.
Yeah. Hide it under a basket? No. I'm going to let it shine. So we had some other topics, but I don't. I think we should give these people a rest.
Seriously. Some housekeeping. Maybe we should put the housekeeping stuff at the beginning of the episode. No, maybe not.
Yeah. No, it's a good idea. Hi, welcome to Unrolled. We're going to start with housekeeping today. Make your bed. Make your bed. And then the rest of the day feels like a triumph.
I got a few questions from folks. So the Unrolled site as well as website as well as the Patreon will be shut down at the end of the month, and that'll all be migrating over to my site. And we will send out an email to everyone who's supported us over the past, just to share the options if you feel like supporting. This will be offered on the same platform as, still for free on your podcast feeds and everything like that. But, the supporting will also get you access to some recorded classes that I record here at Bow Street. And, we may start to wrap our brains around what some bonus content looks like as well, but it'll all just be housed within the one, ryanyoga.com site. And there'll be much more about that once I get all of the kinks worked out. But we will try to keep, again, we're going to do 16 episodes in the latter half of 2019. And a lot of those will be with Kate and I, but then we'll also be inviting some other folks to come on and share the microphone, just so that not all of the heavy lifting is on Kate and mine's schedule. Anything else I'm forgetting?
No, I think that's it.
Okay. Lovely. Lovely, lovely, lovely. Oh, I thought you were gearing up for our standard closing.
Oh, no. No, that was just the sigh of being alive.
Fantastic. Shall we?
And on that note, bye.
Bye.